You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome back on this Thursday morning, June 26th. One technical note, not for the radio listeners, but for folks watching on social media, the feed that we normally have from 6 to 9 a.m. here along with the radio show, we'll have to end that at 8 o'clock this morning and then restart it on the Civic Media Facebook and YouTube pages. So we'll have that little glitch for the 8 a.m. hour today. But here on the radio, you will notice no pause in the programming as we roll along. Before I jump into the decisions yesterday by the state Supreme Court, I just want to thank all of the folks who were part of the Up North News recent fundraising campaign. And on social media, I'm now holding up just a bunch of envelopes, and I'm only showing the back of them, so I don't show people's addresses. But I have the honor of going down to the Chippewa Falls Post Office every so often, P.O. Box 27, 54729, and picking up the mail for Up North News. And every 3 months or so, once a quarter, we have a pledge drive because we, and I believe Civic Media is in this same kind of situation where you have some very large donors, you have sponsors, you have underwriters, but to really round things out, it helps to have, you know, all kinds of grassroots donation support as well. And so all of these envelopes have checks for like $25, $50, some a little bit more. We just ask people, like, we're never going to have a paywall at Up North News for the news and the features that we do. We sometimes have what's called a gate where we say, hey, can we have your email address so you can try our newsletter, see if you like it. But we're never going to have a paywall. And so we say, look, what would a subscription be worth to you? Because I know how much a subscription can be nowadays to like the Journal Sentinel or the New York Times, Washington Post, all those things. And so, you know, if you consider this kind of your morning newspaper, we hope that you'll support us that way. And all kinds of folks do, and they send that in. And again, it's deeply appreciated. There were so many more cards and notes this time than before. People saying thank you for the wonderful newsletters. A lot of these little slips of paper, you know, that people will put a little note on. Keep up the good work. You're doing a good job. I'd like to ask a question. If not Tony Evers, who will run and get elected? We need a middle of the road, appeal to everybody kind of person from Carolyn. Well, thank you, Carolyn, for the nice note and for the question as well. And I know we've talked about that in the past. There is a pretty good bench. I'm not going to say that they're all household names right now, but I think that if the governor decides not to run for a third term, those names will quickly become well known as people jump into what will certainly be a Democratic primary. Let's see, this one from Connie and Randy says, thank you for your news work and your stories from Wisconsin. As seniors, we know that our free press is at risk in these days, and we need more good reporters like you guys. Thank you for that. And this one from Margaret that says, thank you for adding your donation address to the newsletter, as I do not like to use the internet for payments. And again, that's totally fair, which is why we have the P.O. Box 27 in Chippewa Falls, 54729. So again, thanks for the support for all of that. All right, let's look at a couple of state Supreme Court decisions from yesterday that I have to tell you are a little on the head scratchy side. And let's start first with the governor and the way that he vetoed a bill that should have allocated funds for literacy programs in the state. We've talked about this several times, that the legislature approved funding for literacy programs, did the same thing for hospitals in the Chippewa Valley, for getting PFAS out of the water, so forth and so on. And then the governor used his veto powers to partially veto parts of the bill that he thought were onerous, that were micromanaging or tying the hands of people in the executive branch or at local government. And the legislature took the governor to court in the case of the literacy bill to say that what the governor vetoed, or what he did his partial vetoes to, was not actually the bill that appropriated the money. And it's important to make that distinction. When we talk about how the governor can use a partial veto, it is only on budget bills, things that allocate money. On every other bill that's not allocating money, a governor can only sign the bill or veto the bill in its entirety. He can't use his partial veto powers, okay? But here's what the legislature did. In the last state budget, the one that's about to expire here next week, so 2 years ago, there was the budget bill that had all kinds of money in it for all kinds of things in state government, and it included $50 million that it was going to use to support literacy programs. But it did not allocate the $50 million to the Department of Public Instruction. It allocated the $50 million to itself. The Joint Finance Committee has what's called a supplemental fund. Then came a bill called Act 20 that actually created the program, saying that there will be this literacy coaching program. And then 6 months after that came another bill, which became Act 100, which created a couple of different accounts for the money to eventually go into. And it was in that bill, Act 100, that said, was kind of micromanaging, saying that, you know, this much money has to go to voucher schools and has to use these kinds of curricula. And Governor Evers partially vetoed that, saying, nope, the money's all going to go into this one account. Voucher schools aren't going to get any special treatment, and we're not going to tie the hands of the Department of Public Instruction, and we're going to have a literacy program that works. The legislature sued, saying, no. You can't partially veto Act 100, which directs where the money is going, because the money was actually allocated in another bill, the budget bill, and the money was allocated not to the Department of Public Instruction, but to ourselves in the Joint Finance Committee Supplemental Fund. And the governor was saying, no. This bill is clearly the one that allocates the funds, and I can use my partial veto powers on that. Because you guys in the legislature, you put it in this supplemental fund, and that's supposed to be used for emergency funding and for truly supplementing things where the money has run out of a certain fund. You can't just put your money in there and say, well, we'll decide where it goes later, because you know what that is, kids? That's a slush fund. It says, okay, we might approve this budget, but we're going to appropriate all the money to ourselves, and we'll dole it out dollar by dollar, whether, you know, as we see fit. Well, that takes out the checks and balances of the executive branch. The legislature approves the budget and says, here are the places the money should go. And then the executive branch, the governor's office or agencies like the Department of Public Instruction, the DNR and all that, they then take that allocation and dollar by dollar put it to where it's supposed to go. But the legislature wanted to micromanage it. Well, the Supreme Court unanimously, I hasten to add, went along with the Republican point of view that said the thing that Governor Evers vetoed was not actually the bill that allocated the money. And so the veto does not apply. And so the money goes the way that the legislature wants it to go. And Republican legislators were saying yesterday, in reacting to the court's decision, that's great. Now we are ready to release the $50 million because some of it can go toward, you know, voucher schools. Some of it has to go to this curriculum or that curriculum. Basically, all the micromanagement that the legislature wanted to do. They get to do it their way. I don't think that that was the right way to go. I think the lower court got it right. The lower court said that essentially this could be an abuse of power. If you allow the legislature to play games and split up the way that you allocate money into multiple bills, that this one has the money, this bill has the rules, and this bill says what accounts the money can go into. The lower court said those three bills all together, they make up the allocation of the money, and so the governor has the right to partially veto any of those bills along the way. The state Supreme Court said, no, the precedent says we have to apply something called the four corners rule, and that if you look at all four corners of the bill, is it really a budget bill? And this one that talks about where the money should go to which account is not actually, it does not actually fit the four corners test. But I think that, again, the circuit court was right when they said, well, the four corners rule allows the legislature to balkanize or hide the appropriations bill and vastly circumscribe the governor's partial veto power granted under the state constitution. That's how the lower court wrote it. What I feel has happened here is that the state Supreme Court has fallen into the trap of what's called originalism, where the framers, or in this case, the people who wrote Article 5 of the Wisconsin Constitution, did not foresee the bad faith writing of legislation to balkanize or hide appropriations bills. And that's the same problem that we're having in a few other different areas. For example, the framers, the writers of the Wisconsin Constitution, could not possibly foresee that we would have a party operating in such bad faith that instead of using its power of advise and consent for cabinet nominations, that the Senate would simply sit on nominations. And the Senate continues to sit on well over 100 of Governor Tony Evers' nominations, from cabinet level officers to the heads of state agencies to all kinds of boards and departments. And rather than giving them the speedy confirmation they deserve, they just sit on the nominations. And that way, they have the power to hire and fire this person of Governor Evers' choice. That's a complete and total abuse of the confirmation process, and we need to fix that to say, look, Senate, you can have the power to confirm appointees when they're appointed. So pick a time frame, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, whatever it is. And if by that point you don't see a problem with this person, they're confirmed. Because otherwise, you become their employer, and you're not their employer. The governor appoints these people. But again, our framers did not foresee such bad faith actions by a legislature. And the same goes with what's happening here with this legislation and the literacy funds. By saying it's okay for the legislature to appropriate its money not to the Department of Public Instruction, but to itself, to this so-called supplemental fund for joint finance, that's just going to become one big old slush fund. And I'm not saying it's going to happen with this budget, although it very well could in light of this decision yesterday, where the legislature is going to put much, much more of its funding into this so-called supplemental fund and say, well, now we will follow it up with other little trailer bills that allocate the money dollar by dollar, but the governor doesn't have any partial veto power over it. Now, if this all sounds a little in the weeds, I hope that I've done at least a mediocre job of explaining the importance of this, of the checks and balances that have to exist, especially when you have bad faith actors, as we do with this Republican majority, using the power that it has entrenched in itself over 14 years of gerrymandered maps, abusing the confirmation process, and now abusing the budget process as well. This legislature wants to be able to double dip, in that it wants to approve the whole budget, but then it wants to approve dollar by dollar the allocation of that money, removing executive branch authority. And it's not supposed to work that way. We do need reform, but we're going to need a new legislature to get there. Coming up after the 7 o'clock news, I will tackle the other puzzling state Supreme Court decision, one that keeps the gerrymandered congressional maps in place for at least another cycle. But today's history lesson is next, as we always do, mornings powered by Up North News here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
We may have set some kind of a record in the comment sections today. Now, a lot of it has to do with the attack on Iran over the weekend, with people going back and forth about what was constitutional or not. And other stuff, let's just say. Not everybody plays nice in the comment section, if you know what I'm saying. So every so often, it's a little tougher to sift through and find these things. But here from Tony up here, Pat needs a backlight to separate him from his fancy new bookshelf. If we're critiquing, it's hard to separate his black headphones from his black bookcase. Well, Tony, let me grab my fancy new remote control here, and let's try that.
Ooh, look at that.
Look at that. We got it's not like high intensity backlighting, but it's not nothing. So
it appears that you're missing a light.
I am missing a light. I am.
Okay.
Here's the problem with IKEA.
With IKEA? Oh boy. Yeah.
So I ordered all this online. I had it delivered, and I saw the lights up here. They look really nice.
Yeah.
But they don't tell you that if you do more than three lights, you need a separate little power adapter thingy.
Gotcha.
So I have to go looking up the power adapter thingy, and then I can put up, you know, the fourth light that goes there. That's but thank you for noticing. Now it's going to bug everybody when they look at this.
I like to have attention to detail.
Well, that you got. So there, we've taken care of that. It's a Monday morning. It's June 23rd. Appreciate you having you here, and we appreciate State Representative Francesca Hong, who's joining us as well to give us a bit of an update on the state budget. Busy being, you know, mom in the meantime. And is it summer camp season now?
Yes, today is the first day of camp, and of course he did well, and I just had to hover real quick to see if he was all good.
Aw.
Yeah.
I was saying earlier, I had a daughter staying with me over the weekend, and the two little ones, ages 6 and 3, and they left, you know, mid-show here, which is really tough because they're, you know, doing hugs and squeezes and kisses and everything. I'm like, just go. I can't cry on the radio. Just stop it. So I get it. You know, we got to take care of family, especially your job, which has demands in all the weirdest times. You know, you never know when you got to go knock doors or go to a fundraiser or, I don't know, pass some legislation, which would be great to do if you all could get a chance to. But you shared a clip recently of some committee interaction and how the committee chair just really wants to micromanage the conversation in a way that avoids talking about all of the things that go into a state budget. It's not just about, you know, tax cuts for the well-off, but there's healthcare, there's education, there's all these things that are necessary. And, you know, you were simply trying to, I think, make the point that we have a very interconnected budget if you're willing to make those connections.
Well, I think, first of all, I was responding to testimony from the bill authors regarding a bill that would have removed reoccurring referenda. And so I thought that was a really great segue and would give me an opportunity to build some context around what would be driving the need for schools to go to referenda. And the chair of the committee, Representative Joel Kitchens, felt as though that was not pertaining to the bill, interrupted me multiple times. And even though I tried to reframe the question and add additional context, he accused me of trying to always twist the conversation. But especially when Republicans are saying things like historic investments in school and these increasing budgets, that's just not true. And the latest votes that happened in the Joint Committee of Finance executive session last week, the Republican motion included $0 increase in state aid or equalization aid for K-12 public schools. This has not happened since 2011, when Scott Walker administration actually decreased the state aid to K-12 public schools. So it's incredibly unprecedented. I don't love using that word because it's not surprising that the Republicans have very little interest in actually taking care of our kids. But I think it's important for folks to know that what they are presenting in their motions is wholly inadequate. And in addition to the $0 state aid increase, we're talking about 37% special education reimbursement, where remember that is for private schools where public tax dollars are going to voucher schools, they receive 90% reimbursement for the state for their special education costs. And so we're pitting students against one another. And in a time where we should be ensuring that every child has the needs, has their needs met and opportunities to thrive, we're picking and choosing how to fund our schools and really pitting our communities against one another too, when we're forcing taxpayers to raise their own property taxes because the state refuses to fully and adequately fund our schools.
As you were trying to make these points and getting interrupted, I thought of the time when Elizabeth Warren was trying to do the same thing in the Senate and actually was disciplined for continuing to speak, and the phrase, yet she persisted, came into the lexicon. And I immediately thought of that watching you do this, because all I thought you were trying to do, and this is, I'm putting words in your mouth here, was to want to say to the Republicans, okay, look, you don't want these recurring referendums, so you could maybe better fund the schools, right? So that we don't need the referendums. And I just wanted one of them to go, oh, no, we don't want to fund schools. We just don't want you guys to have any more referendums. I mean, at least be honest with folks that way, that that's what this bill is really all about. You just don't like that pesky democracy breaking out.
And we were presenting alternatives and solutions that, again, would eliminate the need to go to referenda. And unfortunately, having a conversation about inadequate public school funding is one that Republicans will continue to evade, because it's something that their communities, people in their district, are demanding. And we saw that with testimony from all across the state, where Wisconsinites showed up to tell Republicans and Democrats on the Committee on Joint Finance what their communities need, that we need a budget that reflects our morals, our values, our needs. And unfortunately, the Republicans refused to listen, especially, and they showed that in their budget motion.
And so I've drawn some parallels to what we're seeing in Congress as well. And it seems like you have more demand than ever for bipartisanship, or at least an attempt to talk to one another. Mm-hmm. And yet in both Washington, D.C. and Madison, you see a side of the aisle that is going out of its way to cut Democrats out of the conversation. And I mean, look, I know there's a lot of people that favor this guy who'd love to bring autocracy to the country, but we are not a land of one party rule yet. And yet it seems like it's really too much to ask that, you know, if they're going to need Democratic votes to pass a budget, maybe they would let you get a word in edgewise before they, you know, implode amongst themselves and can't pass a budget.
Well, Democrats are going to continue to fight for the needs of Wisconsinites and talk about what people are actually asking for in the state budget and how we use their tax dollars. And they're asking for investments in childcare to make childcare services fully more affordable and available for communities across the state, especially our rural communities. We need to be paying childcare educators, making sure providers have what they need to stay open. They're asking for increases, actually demanding increases in public education, both K-12 and higher ed. And instead, Republicans responded with, we're going to do an $87 million cut to the universities of Wisconsin. And so Republicans can I think they really are in disarray. And while we wait for them to get their act together, even though I would like to replace that word with something else,
yes.
Democrats are going to continue to talk about what Wisconsinites want and are demanding of their government, of their representation. And so folks can talk about bipartisanship in terms of working together, but when the other side has continuously left the negotiating table, when they were left conversations with the governor, I think it's really important that we show people who they are. And who they are folks who refuse to listen to their communities. And so we as Democrats have a deep responsibility to ensure that our message is clear, that we are listening to Wisconsinites. We are going to continue to fight for them. And we have no problem going in to communities whose representatives are not listening and talking about how we can collectively fight back and do better for our communities.
We're talking to State Representative Francesca Hong, and here's where we get into some speculation. And again, I'm happy to be accused of overthinking something. But you've got a couple of Republican senators already saying that they're not going to vote for the thing that appears to be coming out of the Joint Finance Committee. So in theory, it could get to the point where Republicans don't have enough votes amongst themselves to pass a budget. And you see some reporters writing, well, they may have to go get, you know, one or two votes from the Democratic side of things. And my contention has been that this is very likely just a head fake. This just clears the path for them to say, you know, we can't agree amongst themselves and we don't want to talk to Democrats, so we're just not going to pass a budget. That there's, for some folks, there may not even be an interest in passing a budget because, you know, spending just continues at the current budget level and they don't have to make any tough choices. Is that wildly speculative? Am I wildly overthinking this, or is a no budget budget a possibility?
Pat, I always appreciate you being thoughtful and analytical. I wouldn't say it's overthinking. It's unfortunate that we are debating on passing a budget that Republicans have presented. This is the Republican budget that they themselves are not agreeing on, that again does the needs of Wisconsinites. I think it's important that we pass a budget that at least makes sure that we are funding public education, childcare, higher education, that we are not opening any new prisons. I think it's important to continue the conversation about Green Bay. Yes, our budget will, the previous session budget will carry over if the budget is not signed as legislation by June 30th. But I also think we have a responsibility to give the governor courage and support to reject a budget that refuses to, that does not meet the needs of Wisconsinites. I think especially with the impending federal cuts and what this big dumb bill that is being worked on, and that the Senate most likely will be voting on this week in the reconciliation bill. It's imperative that the state do everything we can to ensure that communities have what they need to take care of our constituents. And so I think, in addition to the fact that maybe Democrats and Republicans in the Senate are having conversations, a budget that is presented to the governor needs to be one that includes investments in childcare, K-12 education, higher education, and as even though we haven't seen the governor reject the budget in full, this is a much different political climate, mm-hmm. and I would hope we can continue to have that conversation about how we need to fight for a budget that reflects the needs and meets the needs of Wisconsinites.
And now you see why people like Alicia have comments like Representative Hong has the patience of a saint. And we, not the vocabulary necessarily, but the patience. And that's the thing that's important. Fran, thank you so much for taking time out for talking to us in the middle of a busy family day. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Always happy to be here. Thanks so much, Pat.
All right. Jane Mattinair tells us what's coming up next on her program. A local update for the rest of you, all here on our mornings, powered by Up North News on the Civic Media Radio Network. Tomorrow on the program, it's our Wednesday series of visits with all kinds of civic media friends. Earl Ingram in Milwaukee, Todd Alba in Madison. There's Melissa Kay in Wisconsin Rapids, James Kelly in Chippewa Falls, all scattered throughout the show on your Wednesday mornings, powered by Up North News here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're at 7:35. We're going to be visiting with Corrine Hendrickson in just a moment, a child care provider from the Nuglaris area, about what to me was surprising news, and that was Governor Evers essentially drawing the first red line of the state budget cycle, saying that if the state budget bill that Republicans in the legislature send him does not contain funding for the Child Care Counts program, he ain't signing the budget. You know, there's a lot that they can send him that he can fix with his partial veto powers, but you can't fix zero. And so he wants to make sure that Republicans and the legislature take this issue seriously. He gets it. More people in the legislature, more people out in the general public get it. because of the work of so many providers and their allies and folks like Corinne Hendrickson, who joins us now from Nuglaris. Corinne, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I am actually feeling optimistic for once.
I understand that. Were you as surprised as I was to hear the language from the governor?
I was hoping for it. We kind of thought that maybe that was what was happening last week when the Joint Finance Committee did not meet on Thursday because Ag and Department of Corrections didn't seem like they would be the problem. It would be us, and that we heard that they walked away the night before the Republicans walked away. So we were cautiously optimistic that it was us that was the sticking point, but then to have that confirmed yesterday was pretty amazing because childcare has fought really hard and long to be respected, and we are seen normally as less than and seen as babysitters. And we went from not even being part of a conversation 6-7 years ago during campaigns and things to like now the governor is going to veto if we don't get funded. It's amazing.
It really is. It's tremendous recognition of how child care counts has worked in Wisconsin. So, and I apologize if we've got a bit of a weak connection, but we are hearing you just fine on this. I know that last week when Joint Finance canceled, I saw photos of childcare providers who had gone to the Capitol and were standing outside this closed room because the meeting had been canceled. But it just spoke to the dedication of providers and parents and allies willing to go to the Capitol time after time after time to make their case. It really shows how passionate and how necessary this issue is for a lot of families.
Oh, definitely. And we thank our allies and we stand strong with our allies. We are really pushing for that 60% sum sufficient for K-12 because honestly what's happening because the schools are underfunded for special education, when we notice that a child has something going on and maybe needs some extra support and we call the school, it's really hard to get them that support in the program at our place. It's also if we don't have people who know what they're doing and educators, the teachers don't know how to support kids or how to refer kids, because of the turnover, then they don't get what they need either. And these kids, then we end up expelling them. We're struggling to keep them in our programs and they are not getting the support they need till they're 5, 6, 7, or 8, which costs all of us even that much more.
In the Republican caucus, it seems, and I don't want to get too in the weeds about, you know, political things like this, but you do have in that caucus, you have what I guess you would call social conservatives who frankly would rather a parent, usually the mom, stay home. And then you also have a Republican caucus made up of what are very much, you know, your pro-business types who clearly understand the importance of a healthy childcare sector to the economy overall. So as they discuss among themselves, do you feel like progress is being made with people who maybe consider themselves conservatives, but they understand, you know, the economic aspect of this problem?
Yeah, I think there is that weird, like, we support small businesses, but yet you're going to shut down 1,000 small businesses in our state by not funding childcare. They talk about not wanting to, you know, have handouts for people or businesses, but yet we have handouts for agribusiness, manufacturers, pretty much every single industry that exists besides childcare. We don't want to give money to people, but then Voss says we want to give money directly to parents. And so they're just full of contradictions. And I think they're trying, to my opinion, I think they're trying really hard to justify it to themselves, honestly, their decisions.
Well, look, whatever justifies supporting it, however they get there, would be helpful because, again, Governor Evers wanted $480 million into child care accounts. And we don't know what ultimately is going to happen from this, but we know that some people were at zero because they were trying, like you said, they were trying different kinds of, you know, tax credits and things like that. And I know we've covered this previously, but these tax credits, which seems to be the only tool that some conservatives know, they just don't work. They're just not, they're too convoluted for parents and for parents to use, much less providers, right?
Oh, absolutely not. Tax credits. I had to laugh when I looked at the Joint Finance Committee and their tax cuts and how it's going to save the average family $259 a year. That's less than a week of childcare. So, you know, tax credits don't work. And they don't work because, first off, they're not actually increasing revenue for our programs. They're not able to give us the ability to pay people better. And they don't, you know, once a year, getting back a little tiny amount off your taxes isn't going to do anything. And, you know, it kind of goes along with that same hope of, you give money to, and it trickles down to other people. Well, that doesn't work. Tax credits have always been sort of a neoliberal way to compromise. And we've tried it for 40 years. It's not working. Let's do something new.
And one of the things that has also been suggested on the Republican side of things is, again, they love tax credits and they love talking about deregulation. But deregulation in terms of, well, we'll just expand class sizes or we'll reduce some of the requirements, you know, the quote unquote, the red tape for providers. Again, those did not exactly seem popular when they were first proposed because they not only don't get at the heart of the problem, it almost sounds like they'd make some of these problems worse.
Oh, absolutely would make things worse. We can't find teachers. We can't keep family childcare because the workload is too heavy and too hard for such a small amount of pay, $13 an hour. And you're telling me I don't earn that I need to take on 5 or 6 babies in order to earn my $13 an hour? You're just going to increase burnout. You're also going to hurt those kids' development. If we want a strong society, if we want kids who are ready to go into the world when they turn 18 and become military or, you know, next business owners or work for, you know, a wide variety of different people, we need kids who are actually intelligent and can use their brains and, you know, critically think. And when you put too many in a classroom with a teacher who cannot meet their needs, you're going to do the opposite and you're going to cost us that much more as time goes on.
Got on the text line from Tim in Wales talking about part of the reason child care counts works is that, you know, the assistance is given to the child care provider, which is a good reminder for me to take a step back for folks on the child care counts program itself. How does it work? It was funded by federal pandemic aid. The governor now wants, you know, instead state funds to go into child care counts. So that's what would change about the money coming in the door. How does the money go out the door from child care counts? How does it work?
Yeah, so what happens is actually this is the third go around in the budget that the governor has tried to put state money in order to directly fund childcare so we can pay our employees better and family childcare stay open. And so every single program that's regulated in the state is actually able to apply every single month, and we receive an amount for our operational costs and we receive an amount for our per child. And it's based on our quality rating indicator scale. So if we participate in YoungStar, and it's based on the number of children, their ages, we do get more for younger children and our teachers, full-time or part-time. And every single month we get that money and then we're able to offset the cost to our parents for tuition. For example, most of us are sending out letters to our parents right now telling them that as of August 1st or September 1st, when this funding is gone, our rates are going to go up because we need to offset that loss of revenue. And we're doing that to help ourselves so that parents have a way of understanding what's going on, but then also to help educate the Republicans who consistently are saying and accusing us of pocketing this money and not using it to offset those costs for parents. So that if, let's say, in October or November, they decide to actually do something for childcare and put investment in, then we can reduce that tuition back down as well. So, you know, it's really one of those things that they just keep basically lying about us and accusing us of doing underhanded things. And it makes me wonder why they would assume that about other people.
So now we wait to see what they do in terms of putting something into the budget that they would eventually send to Governor Evers. And again, the governor bringing this up indicates to a lot of folks that negotiations are going on and that Republicans are coming off of the number zero for going into child care counts. But that still leaves a lot of room for Republicans to put not $0 in there, but not nearly enough as well to maintain the program. So when we hint at the potential for progress in negotiations, that's no reason to let off the gas in terms of trying to persuade legislators about the value of it, right?
Oh, absolutely not. We told everyone it's working. This tells us that what we're doing, the pressure that we're giving, is working, because for the Republicans to walk away from the negotiating table and for the Joint Finance Committee to not meet indicates to me that within the Republican caucus, they don't agree and that there is some that are feeling the pressure and may want to actually invest in childcare. And so instead of having a hearing that didn't go specifically the way they wanted, not knowing what the votes were, they decided to cancel. And so that tells me that we all need to continue contacting our elected representatives, programs if you're closing, which again, that breaks my heart, and but I get it. You don't want to go into debt any more than you already are. You need to be loud and say exactly why it is you're closing, and parents need to be contacting and say, and they're letting their employers know too, like, hey, without this, I can't come to work and I'm going to need a raise, and get those employers to also contact those representatives.
Yeah, because we have spoken in the past about, you know, a study showing just how many childcare providers, perhaps one in four, would close their doors if state support for all these centers ends in June. And that was a survey of childcare providers commissioned by the Department of Children and Families. It was produced by the Institute for the Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. So, I mean, these are the actual voices of people who can either be part of the solution or can, you know, things can go south real quick if a lot of these places close their door. It's not about a profit margin, Corrine. It's about survivability.
Oh, absolutely. And for those who think that we were okay before COVID, we weren't. We were struggling. We were always relying on women with young children who are desperate enough to either open their family childcare or go work for a group center. And, you know, so that their child is around other children and they can earn a little bit of income, and then we leave. And so we've always had this revolving door, and it needs to stop. It's hurting our children. It's hurting our families. It's hurting our communities.
Corrine Hendrickson is a family child care provider in the New Glarus area. Chris Hambuck Boyle gets on Facebook to say, thank you, Corrine, for your knowledgeable, persistent, and caring advocacy for children. You and Brooke are greatly appreciated. She connects the dots for children, families, businesses, and public schools. I couldn't agree more. Corrine, thank you so much on short notice for taking time and commenting on the governor's comments. We really appreciate it. All right, there we go, Corrine Hendrickson. A little bit of a delay on that, but we definitely got the message through loud and clear, and that was the important part here, is that advocacy works. It doesn't always work right away. It doesn't work every time, but it's in that category of you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And if you don't want to watch childcare centers go out of business left and right, you look for ways to support them in a way that is good for the state economy. A local update is next for some of you. And then in our next hour, we'll be together after the 8 o'clock news to talk to Chad Holmes. And then at 8:30, Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation Area. Live from Lake Wissota, I'm Pat Kreitlow. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
You say you can't get enough Todd Alba, and who can ever get enough Todd Alba? Well, he's going to be part of Matt and Air on Air coming up at 9:30. He and I alternate on Tuesdays at 9:30, appearing with Jane and Greg. So you can catch Todd on Jane and Greg's show today at 9:30. And then on Todd's show at about 3:30 today, Alex Modorsky of the Nature Conservancy will be talking about the Nels Nolson Stewardship Program to conserve land in Wisconsin and prevent overdevelopment. Let's continue the conversation here about childcare for a moment. And we get a follow-up text from Tim in Wales who says, thank you. I had no idea how the program works. I don't think the majority do. I think if more people knew how the program works, it would have more support. How they get the funds, how the funds can be used, how they are tracked. Do all families get the use of the funds, or is it set by income? And the short answer to that is that this is assistance for the providers. Here's an interesting way to think about it. And if we hadn't had a bit of a technical delay, I would have asked Corrine about this directly. But look at it this way. State aid goes to fund our education, our K through 12 public schools, and now voucher schools to a very high price tag as well. But we pay taxes. The taxes go in part to the education of our children from kindergarten through 12th grade. And then there's also state support for technical colleges, the UW system, and more. What we're doing is evolving the system to say education doesn't start on the first day of kindergarten. If you've got quality childcare that allows parents to be in the workforce if they choose to, and you're educating those kids in a safe environment, then why wouldn't some of our tax dollars go there instead to the providers so that they can keep prices reasonable for the parents? Think of it as, you know, the parents paying the child care center is much like we pay property taxes for our part of K through 12 education. So here's where I think you can get Republicans interested in this. What if the alternative to quality child care centers was expanding public education, public schools, what conservatives like to call government schools? Well, we don't have that for child care right now. But if we did, if we started instead of K-12, it was, say, you know, birth to 12 or something like that, and you went to, you know, the local elementary school for your child care, and your state tax dollars went there, that would be one way to go, but conservatives wouldn't like that. What would they say? They'd say the private sector should do this. The marketplace should be doing this. Well, that's what we have right now. So if you don't want every, you know, public school in the childcare business, then you should want the private sector. You should want these parents, these community members who want to care for our children and who aren't part of a government system, but support them with our tax dollars so that our kids are getting good quality care, safety, education from, you know, from the time they're very small until the time that they're out there in the workforce. It's simply expanding the model that says we together are going to care for our children, all of our children, and make sure that they have the best learning environment possible. That's good economic sense. So that's going to appeal to the pro-business conservatives in Republican caucuses. Now, unfortunately, there is a real divide in there. In that room, you'll have your pro-business conservatives, but you'll also have your social conservatives who will say, well, this just, you know, encourages, you know, all women usually to abandon their kids in childcare so that they can go work and they shouldn't be so selfish and they should stay home with the kids. Well, that's a decision that you can make. That's a mindset that you can have. But as an elected official, you know, in terms of what's good for all families in Wisconsin, what's good for the economy writ large, you're going to have to take a look at this issue and see if your social conservative policies are the kinds of things that you can impose on everybody else in the state, the kinds of things you can impose on the state economy. Or do you merely state your case and say, you know, this is what we'd like to do. Let's find the things that encourage at least one parent to stay home. Okay. Now we're talking about nutrition assistance. Now we're talking about health care. Now we're talking about affordable taxes for the middle class, not just for the highest tax brackets. There are so many ways to be pro-family and fiscally conservative and even socially conservative that don't cross some kind of a line of dictating how many kids you can have or have to have. It brings us back to that Sean Duffy piece from the New York Times yesterday, is you can encourage big families if you want, but if as a government, you're not willing to provide ways that make a large family an attractive outcome for a couple, then those are just empty words that you're saying. So take our tax dollars and do the best you can with them from cradle to grave, whether it's good child care, affordable schools, or making sure you don't take away people's Medicaid when they're disabled or their Medicare when they're finally ready to retire. That's really all we want, is a well-rounded budget, both at the federal level and at the state level. And that involves much more than tax credits or red tape, you know? And the red tape one really gets to me. Because we hear that all the time. Oh, we got to get rid of the red tape for the business community. We've got to get rid of the red tape for the business community. But look what they're doing with Medicaid. How are they going to cut? They say, well, we're not cutting. We're just making sure that only eligible people get it through all these additional work requirements, all these reporting requirements. In other words, all this red tape. Similarly, they may come back and say, you know what? We're going to put a whole bunch of money into childcare accounts. But we're going to put so much red tape into it, like reporting requirements and other benchmarks, that many daycare providers decide not to take advantage of it because it's not worth all the hassle. The people that tell you that they're against deregulation and red tape sure know how to use it when they want to for their own partisan purposes. So we'll follow how this goes with the state budget debate as it continues to evolve in Madison. Coming up after the 8 o'clock news, we'll be talking to Chad Holmes from 98.9 WXCO and Dan Schaefer, Civic Media's political editor and founder of the Recombobulation Area. That's all coming up next on this Wednesday, Tuesday morning, powered by Up North News, live from Lake Wissota on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.